I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Richard King. Welcome, Richard.
Lovely to be here, Michael. Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute delight and I'm looking forward to our conversation. Richard, you are the author of this fabulous book, Here Be Monsters. Yes. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
This was shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Prize.
It was indeed, yeah, but I didn't win.
Oh, damn.
Very annoying. Not because I thought it should win, but I just really, really wanted it to.
Well, it will have been an unusual entry in many ways, because you're writing about technology and you're writing about we humans, really asking the question whether technology is going to either reduce our human form or advance it to some strange state where we're no longer who we are today. Is that a fair way of trying to say it?
Yeah, that's a perfect way to introduce the book. So there are, of course, a lot of books on technology out there at the moment, and a lot of them are written, you know, as you'd expect, by people who understand technology, who come from that world, and who have views about how it's developing and how it might develop in the future. What I wanted to do, and I think some of those books are very good, indispensable, in fact, and I draw on some of them in the book. What I wanted to do was to approach the question of technology from a determinedly humanistic perspective, bringing literature, anthropology, philosophy, sociology to bear on this question, because we are now faced with new and emerging technologies that are so powerful, it seems to me, that really we need to pull technology back into the conversation about how we live in community with one another, the political conversation, in other words, and it seems to have sort of given that conversation the slip somewhat. So that's the angle I approached it. Well, you get a lot of debate when a new technology arises about privacy and data collection and these kinds of things. And those are very important questions, but they're the kinds of questions that you'd expect to come up in a society set up along these lines, you know, with a certain esteem afforded to the, you know, the private individual, etc., etc. And what I wanted to do was to think about the ways in which these new and emerging technologies in particular may be working, so to speak, against the grain of our human being, against our creativity, sociality, physicality, etc.
Well, it does that. And what I love is the fact that here's Richard King, who starts out at the University of Sussex. He gets an MA in Literary History and Cultural Discourse, which sort of...
Still not sure what the cultural discourse was.
Well, I was going to ask you. and it intrigues the reader to know you've got that sort of formal academic background. And then you get into all this stuff about, in a sense, about man and machines, technology, science. How did that happen?
Gosh, it's kind of overdetermined in the sense that there were lots of different causes, but as will be evident from the book, I'm a person of the left, and I would go back to the global debt crisis, and after that there was a feeling sort of on, you know, bits of the radical left, if you like, that something was coming to an end and that something new was about to take its place. And there was a lot of what back in the day we would have called accelerationism around, you know, sort of the idea that somehow technology was going to deliver us. And I shared in some of that, you know, and I thought some of it was quite impressive. I got interested in zero marginal cost technologies and 3D printing and renewables, and all of these things are absolutely fascinating, of course. But as I got deeper into it, I started to see that it was very, very limited. And I've been hanging around with a sort of group in Melbourne called the Arena Cooperative for a while, who are very sort of techno-critical. And through them, I sort of discovered writers and a tradition of writing, actually, a tradition of thinking that thought about technology in this very, very deep way. And I was surprised at how surprised I was by it, because these are questions oftentimes that really we should be asking about all of these technologies that come up, and yet we weren't. You know, we were just sort of being quite if not utopian, certainly fatalistic about the new technologies that were coming online. So that's one of the routes into the book. There were others, but...
Well, we do come to realise how, in a sense, gargantuan everything is around us. I mean, at the moment, we're talking about AI, artificial intelligence. We're realising how big that is. As we sit here this morning, the Australian government is pressing on with legislation to regulate deep fake porn that's happening through the AI.
That awful business in Victoria. Yeah.
Well, the whole thing is, in that sense, frightening, and that comes back to the privacy notion that you mentioned, and governments aren't going to be too slow to regulate about that. But others, like Elon Musk and famous people who think and are in the tech part of the world, signed a letter 12 months ago, worried about the existential threat that artificial intelligence in one of its manifestations poses for humanity. Do you share that deeper concern?
I share some of it. I mean, I think the old idea that at some point smart machines are going to become so sophisticated that they sort of cross some hermeneutic threshold into consciousness and then start quibbling about who's in charge, or, you know, crying at the...
Or telling us.
Yeah. Or crying at the sight of three-legged dogs, or, you know, I think that's not going to happen, and we can get into why that is if you like. There's always the risk of something going wrong, of course, and in Silicon Valley they talk about the paperclips problem. I don't think this made it into the book.
No,
but
it didn't.
It's a nice little thought experiment. So you can imagine someone telling an AI to find the most efficient way to make as many paperclips as possible, and then failing, if you like, to sort of parameterize sufficiently this instruction, and the AI will, in this thought experiment or in this thought scenario, will then go and, you know, do some sums and then, you know, sort of calculate that human beings as a fairly reliable source of iron could be rendered into steel and you know, destroys humanity.
That'll still be at work.
So I think probably in the next few years we're going to see see something of that, nothing of that order, but something of that kind, something going wrong, something that suggests that really we are dealing now with it's not intelligent in the sense that we're intelligent, but it is a kind of intelligence after all, something that refocuses just how powerful these machines are. But then at another level, and even if we can get that through under control through regulation, etc., at another level, there's also what happens to us through or as a consequence of our habituation to these smart machines, and that really goes to the monsters of the title. So the monsters of this title aren't sort of monsters lying in wait for us, like, you know, sort of the Terminator Skynet thing or HAL 9000 or anything like that. It's the extent to which we may be becoming or may become uncanny to one another as a consequence of giving up so much of ourselves as a result of these machines. There are certainly things that could go very, very wrong. You know, you see in China, for example, how AI is used in the social credit system. And to be quite honest, some of the thought bubbles that occur in, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area are not a million miles away from that. You know, when they're talking about smart cities and things, of course, there are those sort of civil liberties questions. There's also the question of what could go wrong or what might go wrong. But there's also, I think, the bigger and enveloping question of what kind of relationship to these machines we want.
And that's the big question you're asking, isn't it? What kind of relationship to these things do we humans want? Which leads you into trying to better understand in your own terms and being very open about it. Who are we humans? What do we want? Do we live in communities? Do we want to be in communities? And of course, there are some wonderful sort of experiments, you might say, to test that out in recent times with the novel COVID virus that came through. And we were all locked up in our houses, and people were performing their music groups or themselves on YouTube. They were sort of standing in solidarity, but none of them physically proximate.
Well, that's right. Yes. So I mean, I think that's a great example. So there are the book is divided into three sections, and the three sections relate to what I knew that when I wrote this, I was going to have a minimal idea of what the human condition entailed, at least, and that, you know, you open yourself up somewhat to ridicule when you do that. But I knew that I was going to have to talk in broad terms about what it is that human beings need in order to flourish. So I've divided the book into sort of a section on social life, a section on our physical life, on our embodied nature, and then there's a section on agency and creativity. But really, these three things only make sense when you start to read them, you know, together. And what you found with COVID, your great example of COVID, was that, yes, we were happy to have the video conferencing tools and the smartphones and the social media and all those kinds of things because we could connect to people with whom, you know, with whom we couldn't be physically connected to. But if we didn't know that it wasn't enough, that wasn't enough before COVID, we sure knew it a week or two into COVID. For whatever reason, and I think, you know, the historical background is, you know, takes care of itself. Human beings grew up in, you know, in circumstances of, you know, physical proximity, face-to-face relations. Even writing is only 5,500 years old, you know, if we want to talk about communication technologies. So we need to be together. We've created, I would argue, a kind of society in which we are less together than we were perhaps in the past. And I don't think that's golden age thinking. I think that's just, you know, empirically true. And what these new technologies, in particular social media and the smartphone, do, of course, is to, yes, connect us in some ways, but as all communication technologies do, also allow for our physical disconnection. They all have this sort of double aspect. So while the social media companies often presented themselves as the heroes in the COVID lockdown moment, you know, at the end of the day, social distancing is their business model, isn't it? So I thought that was a very, you know, we had what some people described as an epidemic of anxiety and depression, etc., going into the COVID era, and it appeared to me to catalyze even more anxiety and depression in people, such that, you know, many of the kids can't get back to school.
Well, I was busy writing Fremantle Shipping News stories right through that period. I think it was probably the period I started a regular little feature called Friday on My Mind, where I tried to give my honest views about what I thought was happening in the world and what might happen as a result of COVID, and even made prognostications and predictions, most of which turned out to be false. Didn't think anyone would go back to cruise ships. I thought they'd be very careful before they went back into picture theatres. They've rushed back into the former and the latter. But one thing that seems to have happened, perhaps has happened, is that people have changed work habits as a result of COVID. Do you think that's the case? I mean, you're a writer. You probably haven't changed your work habits at all.
Well, I think I've come to appreciate just how, I mean, I always, because I'm a writer and because I spend a lot of time alone, you know, writing at a screen. I teach just at the university around the corner from here, and that's been my sort of humanity bath. And I knew how important that was, you know, to get out of the house 2-3 days a week just to see other human beings, to be in the same space. But yes, in the COVID period, you know, there was a lot of online learning, of course. First thing to say about that is that the outcomes were terrible. For some reason, I don't pretend to understand, students do not do well in an online class. And, you know, you try as hard as you can to make them meaningful and to make them entertaining and to engage people, but there was just something about them, certainly in that period, that was not working. But yes, a lot of people have, you know, sort of taken their leave of the workspace and are working more from home now. I think that could be a positive development in some ways. You know, it gives people a little bit more freedom and all these kinds of things. As long as we keep in mind, you know, that we need that embodied sociality in order to really be happy, I would argue.
In the book, you do reflect on technology and educational learning. Mm. You're plainly not a fan of letting too much technology like Copilot or ChatGPT or anybody else take it over. Mm. What's your sense about it?
Well, I go right back to Socrates. You know, I talked about this sort of techno-critical tradition of thinking just a moment ago, and really that, I mean, whether it begins with Socrates, I don't know, but certainly Socrates is a good example of it, because Socrates actually took against the technology of writing, and this fact was often sort of trotted out by tech-utopians in the early 2010s. You know, how ridiculous, you know.
A Luddite Socrates
was. Yeah, exactly, you know, a Luddite before the fact, yeah. You know, so how ridiculous to be against the alphabet, you know. But Socrates was asking good questions about writing, and he was coming up with some decent answers as well. He suggested in the, I think this is written down in the Phaedrus, by Plato, because there's an irony here.
Yes.
You know, he never wrote anything down, but it's only Xenophon and Plato following him around with their wax tablets, writing everything down. That means we
and giving him a clip over the ear.
Yeah. So he said, you know, writing would cause the memory to atrophy, and writing does cause the memory to atrophy. Anyone who's made even a cursory study of traditional societies will know that they often have very complex mnemonic systems in order to commit information to memory. And he said as well that, may sound rather odd, but he said a book can't answer back, you know, no more than a painting can answer you back. And that's how he wanted to do his philosophy, in conversation with people in a way that brought out the differences between himself and his students. And I think there's a lot in that. Now, I'm not saying that we should go back to sort of, you know, the agora and, you know, get rid of writing and, you know, standardized testing and all this kind of stuff. But I do. I did hope when ChatGPT sort of emerged in, what was it, late 2022, wasn't it, November 22, I did hope that maybe rather than just trying either to sort of regulate this beast or, which is even worse, assimilate it into assessment design, I did hope that we would kind of stand back from the picture a little and think about, you know, what it is about how we teach these kids that means that so many of them were taken advantage of it. You know, there's no, because I don't think there's any mystery why ChatGPT is so good at writing sort of, you know, academic style essays and so bad at, you know, at the moment at writing poetry. It's because, you know, it's because we kind of made these kids somewhat into automata already. You know? So this is, by the way, you know, this is how automation, you know, happens. It doesn't happen when you install the machines on the factory floor. It begins when Frederick Taylor goes into a factory in the 19th century and says, well, this all looks very, you know, this looks very inefficient. There are a lot of workers here who seem to have a fairly comprehensive idea of what the process is, and as such can lord it over the boss, so we'll just have one worker doing one thing. A pretty alienating existence, I would imagine. And then somebody will come along and say, well, since we've only got one worker doing one thing, then we can probably build a machine that embodies those actions, and that's how automation begins. So I was hoping that people would sort of stand back and think about the picture of education a little bit more broadly, but, you know, I think I was a little over-optimistic there. I'm not saying, I'm not criticising people in the educational space at all, because it was chaos. It was absolute chaos.
Well, what you do, and what you do in Heavy Monsters, is what good writers do, whether they're writing a novel, writing, in your case, what's a non-fiction, but it's like a novel, which takes us through the eons in a way, and keep on asking, you know, how do we live? Who are we? How do these things actually help us? I mean, do we blame Prometheus for all of this? I mean, do we?
Well, yeah. I mean, Prometheus being the trickster who stole fire from the gods. I mean, in a sense, it's a very telling myth, isn't it? Like, I think the thing is, there is no humanity without technology. You know, technology, the use of stone tools, for example, predates the emergence of Homo sapiens by some 3 million years, as far as we know. So Homo sapiens woke up in technology in the same way that anyone listening to this, you know, woke up this morning in technology in the form of blankets and a bed and a roof over their heads, which is part of a house, etc.
Their iPad, their iPhone, their
exactly.
MacBook
all of
Pro.
All of those things, yeah. So we are technological animals and we cannot do without technology in a way that really does distinguish us from other creatures. But what we had until quite recently was, I think, in historical terms, is a relationship to technology where we wouldn't simply adopt new technologies on the basis of their efficiencies. Sometimes we would, of course, but we wouldn't necessarily. So there's some evidence, for example, to suggest that indigenous people, various indigenous nations, had a good look at farming practices, but decided oftentimes not to adopt them, even though they were in some ways more efficient. So what we have now is a sort of instrumental view of technology whereby, well, if something can be, and this is because, of course, of the system in which these new technologies are developed, where if something can be done more quickly and more efficiently, then it's adopted almost as a matter of course, without any discussion at all about, you know, how we might like, what kind of relationship we might want with this thing. And that's a big problem, I think, especially when you have technologies, and we're not only talking about AI here, but we're talking about genetics and nanotechnology and the whole range of technologies. Technologies that are, so to speak, reconstitutive, that don't merely allow us to bend capricious nature to our will in the way that all technologies do, but to intervene in nature at the smallest levels. You know, so we can now, you know, give effect to processes that don't occur naturally anywhere on Earth. I mean, a great example would be the splitting of the atom.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask about the splitting of the atom. I'm not sure what the right word for it is, but it's for us, isn't it? We're humans, probably the moment in our history gives rise to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Gives rise to every sense of unease on our planet as we sit here talking today, because the combatants are holding nuclear weapons and they could drop them. But it also makes me wonder whether these things were inevitable. I wanted someone, maybe they have done it, and you can tell me, Richard, to sit down at the earliest point in time and map out the human social history with the political, the economic, the social, and the environmental all there. It seems to be a constant escalator, if you like. It's going up and it's moving fast. You can get off it, but it keeps on going if you try. And it doesn't seem it can be stopped. How would you regulate Silicon Valley so they didn't do all of these things?
Yeah, well, I mean, it does seem like that, doesn't it? I would push back against it slightly. There's this sort of genre of history that's grown up in the past couple of decades called big history, and they love it in Silicon Valley because it tells precisely this story of, if you like, exponential increase in sophistication and power. And we've got Moore's Law, of course, which suggests that, you know, computing power, doubles every 18
months. Well, we lost Kodak, BlackBerry and all these other forms of things too.
Yeah, absolutely. Saw a very good film on that the other day, actually, about BlackBerry. It was rather good. I can't remember the name of it, but I'll try and get it. So that's the story that is told. And I think Silicon Valley loves to tell this story because they can present themselves at one and the same time as being, you know, these brilliant individuals, but in some sense as well, the representatives of the species. You know, we're going to create this new contraption and it will carry us all forward into the future. And I think, I'm as sure as I can be that history doesn't develop like that. And, you know, you go through long periods of history where there's really no particular, you know, technological development to speak of at all. It's only when you get, I think the big takeoff is probably around the Industrial Revolution.
Well, James Watt has a lot to answer James for.
James Watt, Joseph Jacquard with his looms, etc., etc.
And the stock exchange.
Yeah, then the stock exchange.
Capital comes in behind all of these. The patent.
Yeah.
People patent.
That's right.
Their things.
Yeah.
And some argue that that's the complete basis and rise of Western capitalism over the last 300 or 400 years.
That's right. And you get industries having with their own research labs and all this sort of thing, creating new chemical compounds, etc., in order that they can patent them and make money out of them. It's worth saying as well that part of the problem with technology, and one of the things that we should be thinking about, is that these new and emerging technologies are all developed within a system that seeks ultimately high private returns, not high social or environmental ones. So,
well, in a sense, it doesn't have to be the case, but that seems to be the case. Mm. The EU have just brought down a law a month or less ago. I wrote about it on Free Metal Shipping News to try and regulate the worst safety dangers of AI. There is encouragements for nations around the world to think of doing the same. They first met in London just less than 12 months ago. They just met in South Korea last month. And it's to deal with, yes, all the terrible, obvious things that can happen out of it.
Yeah, again, and those, you know, and I think, you know, there'll be something like that happens, you know, because what are we regulating at the end of the day? I mean, even the people working on these machines, thinking about AI now, don't always know how they're going to work. And, you know, there are safety questions around nanotechnology and things like that as well. You know, you could have a self-replicating nanobot or something like that just didn't stop. Of course, the grey goo scenario. So there are all sorts of things that can go wrong, but also there's there's the background issue of what kind of relationship we want to have with our machines and what they're perhaps giving us, yes, but what they're taking away from us as well. I think part of the problem is what I call in the book the instrumental view of technology. So the Silicon Valley view of technology is an instrumental one, and it is encapsulated in this phrase: it's just a tool. We can use it badly, we can use it wisely. Whether we use it badly or wisely has nothing to do with the tool itself. You know, I can use a hammer to drive in a nail, I can use it to bludgeon my next door neighbour to death when he puts grass clippings over the back fence or something like that. Sorry, slightly violent image, but park that. I take a different view of technology. I call it the substantive view, or the ecological view, which is even better. This was Neil Postman's term for it. He wrote about television very well back in the day, and he was Marshall McLuhan's student.
Well, television was free-to-air television. It was going to, in a sense, destroy us all, numb our minds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Every parent would go crazy about whether their kids would ever do anything at school. Yeah. Free-to-air television has just about died.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's all streaming now. He said that technology, it changes the human element in the same way that a drop of dye changes a glass of clear water.
It's
good, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And so you add the printing press, and you put the printing press into Europe, and you come back 100-150 years later. You don't get old Europe plus the printing press. You get a different Europe entirely. You get a Europe in which, yes, literacy is beginning to spread. Religion is perhaps taking on a more individualistic aspect for complex reasons. And you've got the beginnings of what we now call the public sphere, so a sort of virtual space into which intellectuals and philosophers and scientists and engineers can go and if you like, swap ideas, compare epiphanies. You've got all of those good things happening. You've also got, you know, less good things happening, because as a consequence of that public sphere, what you've got is a rise in nationalism. People are beginning to identify with communities who, again, aren't physically present to them. And you can make an argument that really the nation state comes out of the introduction of printing. So it's a mixed legacy. But this is the way that I think we need to try and think about technologies in general, if we're going to have a more, if you like, democratic relationship to them. If we're going to get, if we're going to, that's to say, get them back into the conversation that we want to have about how we live.
The test for some people is going to be different from the test that others use for whether technology is helping or not.
Yes.
You, as you said earlier, and in the book, are quite clear towards the end. You say, I've always had a socialist view of the world and this community-based approach to doing things. And that's where I want, my words, not yours, technology to fit in. I want to evaluate it for how it's assisting, developing, promoting a view of the planet and our human future that I like. Other people seem to have different.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely. So the question, I think that's a very, very good point. It's very important. The question of what you want from technology is also a question about who you are, which is to say a philosophical question. So it's always going to come back to that. You know, it's a radical discussion in the sense, you know, radical meaning, you know, going to the root. What do we want from technology? I would try to keep that end of the rope up, but you're quite right to say that there are other, you know, people from other political traditions who would say no. You know, from the liberal tradition, for example, who would say no. The fact that it gives us so much quote unquote freedom to do so many things and to get so many things, you know, means that in terms of our flourishing, these new technologies, so to speak, pay for themselves. I would just make the point that human freedom depends, you know, for me and for people within this tradition, generally, I think I can confidently say, freedom is not just not having someone there bossing you around. Freedom means living out your full humanity, which means exercising your agency, which means a certain amount of creativity. We often talk about alienation, for example, and how alienating forms of work and that sort of thing. The whole world is disappearing now into a black box that we don't really understand. So alienation is a big problem, I think. So I think freedom, if it's going to be a substantive idea rather than just a sort of formal political proposition, has to include a notion of what it is that we want our human lives to entail. There are lots of paintings around this beautiful office that somebody has put a lot of love into, you know, and I hope it's clear that there's a lot of love and creativity and agency going on in that book too. So, you know, this is what life is about, I think. It's not peculiar to the kind of socialist tradition. There are probably enlightened conservatives who think this way as well. But
well, one of the things that seems to bind people very often, and you have a whole chapter on Facebook, I should say Meta, the Metaverse. We had what I thought was a fabulous movie because it was so contemporaneous. Was it Social Network at the time?
Yeah.
The rise of Zuckerberg and his legal battles with the guys who said you pinched it off me, us. But this thing comes on the scene. It's an immediate mechanism, new technology to enable people to communicate. Talk about Gutenberg and the printing press. I mean, here's this thing, you go in, you bring up an app, you find out people. I discover there's a writer's group and Richard King's on it. I heard about him, I can send him a message and this whole thing takes off.
Yeah.
And you can start to argue whether that has created further social separation and less physical contact. But this thing happens and then Twitter comes along. But now parents just, you know, want to get their kids off the computers. They don't want them being exposed to dangers on any of these social media platforms.
That's right. And even if you could get rid of the dangers, I still think you'd have a problem because, again, it comes back to that, you know, embodied presence of others. And just spending so much time in that space is, we know, it's not healthy. Another movie that we should mention is The Social Dilemma. You know, Jonathan Haidt, the psychologist, has some very interesting statistics about suicidal ideation and anxiety amongst teenage girls especially, and pre-teenage girls, since, you know, the first generation of teenage girls to be socialised on social media, for example, aren't doing well emotionally at all. We talk about social media platforms, it's worth digging down into this perhaps, and we talk about social media platforms being addictive, but that really doesn't tell you very much, because we're not addicted to the platforms any more than a heroin user is addicted to the powdery texture of heroin. What we're addicted to is the feelings afforded by the stimulus, and the feelings in this case are feelings of connection with others. So social media, it's going to sound like a tautology, but social media only works because we're social creatures. The trouble is that we're being dosed with a form of sociality which is less than we need in order to do well emotionally. And so this is what worries me about social media. And I don't know why there hasn't been a more robust conversation about whether or not we should be having phones in schools. There's plenty of discussion about vaping, which, you know, to be honest, on a, you know, on a scale with social media and smartphones, doesn't bother me that much, you know. It bothers me a bit, of course it does. It would bother me if my kids started vaping. As a former smoker myself, I know that's not a good idea. But, you know, I'm absolutely as sure as I can be that that smartphones and social media aren't doing them any good. And I would like to, you know, I mean, this is a fairly simple thing that we could do, you know. And yet we haven't done it. Again, there's a lot of fatalism around. Less utopianism around than there was, but plenty of fatalism the scene.
My background is as a lawyer and interested in policy and how you can use law to produce socially desirable outcomes as voted on by some sort of majority. In fact, I once wrote for the Commonwealth Department of Science and Environment a report on regulating recombinant DNA. And this raised the whole question, which you also touch on in the book, about the notion of playing God and how you do it. But I am fascinated, Richard, by the fact that we grow up in what used to be called liberal democratic societies. We've got all these other forces at work when it comes to governance and how we run our societies. But are you relying, by asking lots of questions in the book, on good, intelligent, thinking people to change the way we do things, to, in a sense, self-regulate, or go further than that and demand of governments new laws to, in some cases, to reverse perhaps what has happened?
This is the most difficult question to answer, I think, because we are so far away from a form of politics that would have these kinds of questions at their centre. I think all we can do in the short term is to, and I'm sorry it's such a mundane answer to your very good question, but I think all we can do in the short term is to become a little bit more technocritical ourselves. Yes, limit our use, think about what kind of relationship we want with technology and those kinds of things. I then think there's a sort of intermediate stage where we'll need to think, especially as we get into the anthropogenic climate change crisis. I mean, we're in it already, but as we move deeper into it, we're going to have to start thinking about, probably at some point, lowering our consumption. That might entail growing, I don't know, more of the stuff that we eat closer to where we actually live. It might entail, I don't know, permaculture projects. It might entail redesigning schools such that, yes, they remain, if you like, instrumental, but, you know, rather than just having a garden in one corner of the playing field, that becomes like a real, you know, a really important thing. How to grow your own vegetables, that sort of thing. How to work on your own house. They used to have this in the US, the old shop class, for example. You know, you would get great skills that you could use either in work or indeed at home and throughout your whole lives.
Well, one way and the other, the art of motorcycle maintenance might take off.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Oh, well, there's a lovely, what's his name? Oh, gosh, I'm going to forget.
You write about him in the book.
Matt something, yeah. He's a very interesting figure. Oh, I'm... I'm so sorry, I can't remember his name, but he's an old academic and a sort of conservative think tank guy, and he decided to jack it all in and become a motorcycle repairman. And he writes these wonderful books about the rewards of, if you like, tinkering, of physical labour, you know. And their intellectual rewards and their physical rewards, you know, and something like, you know, building something like that back into the education system, I think would be very, very positive.
You can I was going to say, one can romanticise some of this.
Oh, yeah.
You make the point, I think, about your great-grandmother
yes.
working in service in London.
With the, yeah.
And absolutely. You said, I'm sure she would love to have an automatic washing machine.
Oh my goodness, yeah. Well, as it was at the time, it would have been a mangle, yeah. And just a horrible way to try and do the laundry, you know, back-breaking stuff. Yeah, that's absolutely true. So again, I'm not being anti-technology. What I'm for is a conversation, and there are all kinds of technologies. Renewables is an obvious one, but 3D printing, I think, is very exciting. You know, if we can keep that open source, that's a real that opens up a lot of opportunities for people, I think. I'm for a conversation about what kind of relationship we want with the technology, not being against technology. There are technologies you certainly wouldn't want to be without. I mean, the one that always comes to my mind is painkilling medication. You know, for most of human history, we would have, you know, human beings would have died in absolute agony. You know, I think, and to go back to the question of what we can do, until we can, you know, it will start at a local level, but what will have to happen eventually is that a political party or a political movement will have to come into being that includes in its platform a new offer about or a new approach to question, you know, to technological questions. At the moment, I have to tell you, we are so far, I mean, we're going in the opposite direction. So even green parties internationally, my friend Guy Rundle writes a lot about this. Even green parties internationally are like, you know, are becoming pro-nuclear and this sort of thing, you know, which for Greens in the past was an absolute no-no, you know. And I find it very, I find that very distressing. So I think, if anything, even those groups are becoming more, if you like, techno-solutionist than they were in the past. But this is in response to an emergency. So you know, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. it's a big mountain to climb, but and it does begin small. But that's what would have, you know, it would have to happen. It would have to be a multi-layered approach to these questions, I think.
One thing that fascinated me was this: towards the end of Here Be Monsters, suddenly Bruce Pascoe's Dark Emus appeared, and Sutton and Walsh's Rejoinder, which I read both of with great interest at the time.
Yeah.
Sutton and Walsh criticised Dark Emus really for romanticising what the position was pre-European settlement.
Mm.
But here we are, sitting in the west end of Fremantle, pretty much where the British imperialists arrived 195 years ago, almost to the day in June 1829, and displaced as far as they could and as widely as they could the indigenous owners of the land.
Mm.
Your point, as I read it, was to say, here are these people who've lived here, in a sense, forever, who related to the land. And taking the Sutton and Walsh point, they weren't running a highly technological society.
No.
You shouldn't criticise hunters and gatherers.
No.
You should quite happily say, yes,
yeah, that
the Whadjuk people here were hunters and gatherers,
yeah,
by and large.
Yeah.
And is there something to be learned from that? Were you trying to tell
definitely.
Us there's something to be learned?
Yeah, I think so. I think, Bruce, look, I have no desire at all, of course, to join in that awful pile-on that occurred in the pages of Quadrant.
It's all worth reading because you're so much better educated when you've read it all, just Bruce and
it
not
really
just...
It really is. It really is. But I think the mistake Bruce made with Dark Emu was to... I mean, we should say that he verballed the evidence, really, I mean, it's not a great use of the evidence that's going
on. Well, you can't take a couple of fish traps and say they ran a big fishing industry.
Exactly. There was some evidence of, there is some evidence of incipient agriculture, but he built that up into a thesis that I don't think it deserved to be built up into. But what he'd done, and this is what interests me, because what he'd done by doing that, and I think Sutton and Walsh make this point, although Sutton in particular I think has been unnecessarily rude about it sometimes.
Incisive mind, Peter Sutton.
Yeah, he is an incisive mind. Yeah, I'm not criticising him, but I think Bruce is obviously, you know, in a fragile place.
He was doing it in the academy, not in the public place.
Yeah.
Could have been written differently.
That's right. What Bruce had done, I think, was to buy into an idea of progress. This goes back, actually, to your earlier question about the arc, if you like, of technological development. He'd bought into an idea of that was actually, and ironically, very Western-centric. You know, it's not the case that agriculture is necessarily an improvement on hunter-gathering. The hunter-gatherers here had a fantastically sophisticated system of production, you know. And I think he bought, you know, I think he, you know, for good reasons, and you know, because he wanted to, I think, to push back against this idea that somehow the indigenous people who lived here were in some sense, you know, just like kind of nomadic savages, what have you. So that comes from a good place. But I think in doing that, he'd bought into an idea that agriculture was was axiomatically an improvement on hunter-gathering. And I think that's Sutton and Walsh's point. And I think it goes to how deeply embedded that view is, that somehow we're all on this trajectory towards, the kind of world that we have now, which is which is a world in which we are enmeshed in.
The instructions, it seems, in the Judeo-Christian ethical documentation is to exploit the planet.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's what people in the West have been doing for some hundreds of years.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the Aboriginal people here weren't.
Yeah.
Not in the same way.
Very good historian of technology called, I think, David Noble, who writes about the symbiosis. I'm very interested in this at the moment because of a new book that I'm writing, and the symbiosis of religious thinking and the sort of early industrial revolution and how those two things actually came together. We think of them as being in conflict, but actually, if you listen to a lot of the, you know, people who are into geoengineering, a lot of the eco-modernists now, they have what amounts almost to a religious faith or fervour. Certainly there's a kind of religious exuberance there, you know, in the way a lot of them talk. Stuart Brand said, didn't he, you know, we are as gods and may as well get good at it, you know. So,
Richard King, it's been really lovely talking to you about your book, Here Be Monsters. It's got some fantastic praise, magnificent, one of the books of the year, An Intellectual Map for Our Times, an extended essay of uncommon eloquence.
Thank you.
Calm, clever and lucid book. Lively, a bright and magnanimous reminder, which I totally subscribe to, that it ought to be required reading, as someone else
Thank
has said.
You
draw so much together. You've got, you know, the German philosophers bounding about. You've got, you know, the thinkers from the Enlightened. Heidegger, you have to have Heidegger in there. My son will be very pleased. He's a student of the German philosophers. Are you an optimist when it's all said and done, or do you think perhaps we humans are done for in our present form?
I think the way I would phrase it, I think I used the phrase already, would be to say, I think it's an old Gramsci line: pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. What's the alternative to hope? That's my question. Indifference at best, nihilism at worst. Well, there's plenty of nihilism around at the moment, so I'll stay on the side of hope. But it means, you know, it means endeavour, it means effort, it means thinking about these questions and
asking,
talking to each other, having conversations like this, for which thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for coming and joining me today.
Thank you.